British politics and chaos today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Want to know what the heck is going on in the UK post-Brexit? Yeah, me too. So I tried asking a veteran BBC political correspondent.
Why on earth would anyone listen to anyone like me or anybody else who claims to know anything about politics when everything is so utterly up in the air?
Turns out a lot of Brits feel that way.
We have no idea who's going to be leader of the main two political parties in 2 or 3 days. We have no idea what's going to happen to the pound. It turns out that nobody had a plan.
Plus, following a trail of thought to catch a terrorist.
The only breadcrumbs that these suspects leave is in the form of a thought, a violent thought, that is expressed through speech.
Those stories and more today on The World. Thanks for being here. So from Hail Britannia one day to Oops Britannia the next, it seems no one was prepared for the actual result from last Thursday's referendum to leave the European Union, not even the UK's politicians. Prime Minister David Cameron announced he's resigning, but no one seems to be ready to follow him. Meanwhile, the leader of the opposition Labour Party is under attack from his closest colleagues for poor leadership. It seems like all the UK leadership has been thrown into a blender. To understand this story, it helps to understand British politics right now. So we called up my colleague at the BBC, Rob Watson. He's their political correspondent. Rob, parliamentary democracy is already a big shift from the American system. So help us understand what the British system looks like in a blender. Start us off with the top job. A U.S. president can't just quit because of one vote that didn't go his or her way. So what's happening with David Cameron?
Marco, it's difficult to know where to start because British politics have been, I was about to say, remade by the referendum result, but I think that's not right. It's just broken. I mean, it's just completely broken. So where to start? Well, the way Britain works is it's a parliamentary democracy. So you you derive your authority as prime minister from the fact that you just have more MPs than anyone else. But if something goes disastrously wrong, like losing a referendum, normally the prime minister would resign. So David Cameron has. But to sort of step back from it even further, you know, in Britain, it's a bit like the kind of Democrat-Republican Party thing. I mean, essentially, since about 1919, 1920, people can write in if I've got it a bit wrong, you know, Britain has been governed by governments that were either, you know, basically conservative or basically the Labour Party. Imagine things now where both of those parties, the two major parties in Britain, are in absolute turmoil. So the Conservative Party has lost its leader in David Cameron and is looking for a new one. And in a way, the opposition Labour Party is in even more of an existential bind because it's trying to figure out what is its purpose in life. It used to be very much the party set up for the working classes, it used to work in the factories of Britain's northern cities. But it was those kind of people, those working class voters, who completely defied the Labour Party in voting against its wishes and voted to leave in droves for leaving the European Union. So that's what we have, this absolute turmoil in both parties.
Is there an opening for a third party, just as an aside here?
I think not without changing Britain's political system. But I'm just going to say this, Marco. Why on earth would anyone listen to anyone like me or anybody else who claims to know anything about politics when everything is so utterly up in the air? So I guess my caveat would be, I mean, who on earth knows? I mean, it's completely new territory. And one of the things that I was thinking about over the weekend through my kind of sleep-deprived haze was just how quickly you can go from having a system that seems pretty clear and stable and nicely set up to absolute chaos. I mean, it really is quite extraordinary. And, you know, partly, you know, what has happened in the referendum is that lots of things that have been sort of bubbling up in Britain for a long time, you know, were able to become starkly apparent in a way that they're not usually in a general election because of our system, which favours big parties. But when you got a really stark choice, like should we stay in the EU or leave, you know, it was this opportunity for the country to divide in really kind of disturbing ways along lines of class, along lines of wealth, of age, of where you live. I mean, you name it. It's just, you know, it's just mold breaking.
Well, let me get back to the task at hand here, which is understanding parliamentary democracy in the UK in a blender. So who is set to replace David Cameron?
Well, the most likely candidate is Boris Johnson, the man who really made Brexit possible. And here's the kind of psychodrama in this. Former mayor of London and went to the same school, former schoolmate of David Cameron. They went to the same university.
Does that mean they're friends?
Well, they used to be. I shouldn't think that they're best of mates now because, in some kind of Greek-type tragedy, appropriately for someone like Boris Johnson, who studied classics, he's done his old mate in.
Finally, Rob, a lot of people are asking, in this massive wake of regret, does the Brexit really have to happen now? I mean, is there a chance Parliament could overrule the referendum?
Well, I mean, technically speaking, the referendum is what's known as advisory. In other words, it wasn't, it doesn't legally oblige the government to do anything.
Non-binding, as we say.
Non-binding. Yeah. So, technically it could. But I wouldn't like to be the one who had to explain that to 17 million people who voted to leave. I mean, look, it may be the case, and we've certainly got anecdotal evidence of this, that there is already a certain amount of buyer's remorse, I think it's described, amongst a lot of people voting to leave, saying, yeah, let's just show the government, let's show all those posh rich people. And they may be regretting it a bit. But seriously, to reject the entire referendum, I wouldn't want to be the one to tell the 17 million, oh, well, we're just having a laugh, don't worry.
My partner at the BBC, Rob Watson, thanks very much, Rob.
Thank you, Marco.
One thing that is no joke, since last Thursday's Brexit vote, there's been a disturbing rise in anti-immigrant incidents in the UK, many of them directed at people from Poland. Last week, we spoke with Rok Dunin-Wasowicz on the show. He's a researcher at the London School of Economics. He's also Polish and has done a lot of research on Polish workers in Great Britain. So you saw a number of scenarios playing out on Friday, Rok, but with the news of Brexit still pretty fresh, things were kind of unclear. After this weekend and what you've seen with just polls in the UK, how are you feeling on Monday?
We are seeing that we're reaping a harvest of the vilifying rhetoric against Central Eastern European migrants that was created and perpetrated by some of the people on the Leave side.
Yeah, what kind of events stood out for you this weekend in kind of a negative way?
Well, two things are most prominent. One is people receiving vilifying racist leaflets around Cambridge. And the other one was when the Polish Cultural Center in Hammersmith in West London was vandalized and someone wrote racist slogans on the door.
And those leaflets that were being distributed in Cambridge, who's sending those out and are they being targeted at the Polish community?
They're definitely targeted at the Polish community because they say, in a quote, no more Polish vermin, both in Polish and English. So they're clearly targeted at this specific group. And the same thing is the case in London where, this is the Polish Cultural Center that's been there for 50 years. So this is pretty deliberate.
I mean, given how cosmopolitan London is, are you surprised at what's going on in London?
I am quite surprised because I would say that for sure, in some of the more deprived areas of this country, migrants are competing for work with the domestic population to a degree. Obviously, this has been much more exaggerated, the degree of it. But it is happening. There's no denying of this. However, in London, this is absolutely unprecedented. And we have no idea who's done it, but it's a deliberate attack. It is motivated by xenophobia, by racism, and it's very disconcerting.
And how would you describe the atmosphere generally in London right now, whether you're a Pole or anybody who is not originally from there?
We had Pride here over the weekend, and a lot of people came out with European Union flags to celebrate gay Pride, so that was telling. Sadiq Khan, the new mayor of London, during Pride, said that all European migrants are welcomed in this city. There is a lot of support for the Polish community, at least in the official channels. However, what is happening on the ground and in other places not as metropolitan and cosmopolitan as London, that could be a very different reality.
So that tension, Rok, how does that make you feel as a Pole living in the UK?
I think this is just starting to confirm some of my worst worries about what this vote may trigger in the future for the stability of this country and the European Union as a whole.
What do you do as a Pole, though, to counter that discrimination?
I think that community organizing should be happening in all different areas of this country where there's a huge concentration of Polish migrants. So it's up to the authorities, up to the community organizers, leaders from different backgrounds, not just Polish backgrounds, to stop this from escalating. You know, people from other minorities in this country should also come out in support of Central Eastern European migrants.
I mean, the fact that the mayor, the new mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, represents this welcoming face of the UK really suggests the divisions of this vote. Where do you see these divisions headed?
Well, that remains to be seen. I think right now, both the leavers and the remainers are really set on diffusing these tensions. However, because of this uncertainty, both the political and the economic one, it's pretty difficult to do this just now. It's a bit gut-wrenching right now. I mean, I don't want to be exaggerating in terms of these attacks. I think these are negligible so far, but things are getting out of hand politically in the general, scope of things. So we just don't. No one knows where we're heading. There's no government and there's no opposition.
Ragdunan Vasevic with the London School of Economics. Thanks for your time. Good to speak with you again.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
We thought of Jessica Gonzalez Rojas when we heard news from the Supreme Court today. The justices ruled 5-3 to strike down a law in Texas that would have cut the number of abortion clinics in the state dramatically, a law that could have had sweeping implications for other states. As head of the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health, Jessica Gonzalez Rojas has been following the Texas case closely, and today she's celebrating.
On behalf of the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health and the 2.5 million Latinas in Texas of reproductive age, we are thrilled by today's decision. It removes so many of the barriers that were erected to access abortion care in the state of Texas, and it sets a precedent to prevent these type of laws being enacted throughout the country.
So briefly explain to us the Texas law that was in question. How would it have restricted abortion access? And had the number of abortion providers in Texas already been cut as a result of it?
Yes. Well, before the law, there was about 41 clinics in the state of Texas. And basically, the Texas legislature knew they couldn't outlaw abortion outright. So what they decided to do was make it harder and harder for the clinics to operate in the state of Texas. So the other part of the law would also require providers of abortion care to get admitting privileges in nearby hospitals. And this is all done under the guise of women's health. But the reality is that abortion is 14 times safer than childbirth. And for those doctors who even got admitting privileges, it was difficult to maintain them because abortion is so safe, they almost never have to admit anyone to the hospital. There's 5.4 million women of reproductive age in the state of Texas. 2.5 million are Latina. So Latinas are disproportionately impacted by this type of law. So we are thrilled that the justices saw through the sham of this law and decided to strike it down as unconstitutional.
I mean, it seems like not much will change unless the number of those trained doctors and clinics dramatically goes up now. So this can't be the end of the fight. Is that kind of the next step for you?
Yes, it is not the end of the fight. As we say, we celebrate today, but tomorrow we're back out in the streets and we're fighting to ensure every person has access to the ability to make the best healthcare choices for themselves, their families, and communities. And there's always restrictions that the Texas legislatures and other legislatures across the country are thinking of to continue to deny access. And that includes waiting periods and, other onerous restrictions that deny care. So we are looking to continue to fight and ensure that all people have access to the health care they need, no matter how much money is in their pocket, what kind of insurance they have, their immigration status. For Latinas in particular, we were dealt a blow last week with the Supreme Court's decision on U.S. versus Texas, which denied protections for the undocumented community that are living and working in the United States. Mm. So we look at the issues very intersectional. So that decision impacts an immigrant woman's decision or ability to get health care in this country. So we're going to keep fighting till all our community members are able to get health care.
Jessica Gonzalez Rojas, Executive Director of the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. How do you prosecute a thought? This is not a philosophical question. It's a practical thing law enforcement authorities are struggling with right now. When does a violent thought become a crime? Rukmini Kalamaki has been writing about this for the New York Times. She points out that U.S. authorities had Orlando shooter Omar Mateen on their radar before the attack on the Pulse nightclub, and French authorities had a guy named La Rosie Abala on a watch list, too.
This attacker, who's a 25-year-old man, went after a police officer who he tracked to his home in Magnanville. He stabbed him to death in the driveway of his house and then forced his way into the home and stabbed and killed the man's wife. And in the moments before police closed in, he recorded a video that he uploaded to the internet on Facebook Live, where he makes clear that he was acting under the oath of the Islamic State.
The problem here was that the French authorities knew about La Rosia Bala, but they didn't have concrete evidence to act on, right?
Exactly. And this seems to be happening again and again, at least in France. We're seeing that many of the perpetrators, including the ones that did the November 13th attack in Paris, were known to authorities, and many of them actually spent time in jail. In La Rosia Abala's case, he was first arrested in 2011. He spent a little bit more than 2 years in jail for belonging to a terrorist cell that was sending young men to Pakistan. He was, however, deemed to be the youngest and most junior member of that cell, and they were not able to conclude that he was a permanent threat to the homeland. So in 2013, he's released. He's placed under surveillance until the end of 2015. And just months later, this year, he goes ahead and does this double murder.
Yeah, so what can authorities in France anyway act on? Like if they came across a social media post or an email in which someone talks about threatening lives, could they act on that?
They can. The problem that we're facing with this terror threat is that often the only breadcrumbs that these suspects leave is in the form of a thought, a violent thought, that is expressed through speech. And so when you're in the face of a legal system like ours, which respects civil and personal liberties, it becomes very hard for prosecutors to argue that somebody making a violent statement on Facebook is really going to take the next step and kill somebody. Because there are lots of people that make such statements and never proceed to the next step.
So how big a problem is this in terms of just investigating what we might know? And how does it compare in France to the U.S.?
The legal systems are somewhat different, but I think the challenge is the same. And the FBI director, James Comey, said almost as much when he held a press conference after the Orlando shooting. And he explained that they are sifting through a nationwide haystack, which includes hundreds and hundreds of suspects. And they're trying to find that one needle, or he actually put it, that one part of hay that might turn into a needle. And again, they're always dealing with the expressions of these people. There's rarely an act of violence that precedes the actual terrorist attack. And so without that, it becomes hard to put them away for good.
I don't want to refer to Hollywood for solutions, but I think of the movie Minority Report, kind of predictive investigations. And actually, in Chicago, the murder scene there is so bad that the police are kind of coming up with a version of that. I mean, is there anything to kind of look at there?
It's funny that you mentioned Minority Report. I actually cut out a quote from one of the lawyers involved in the La Rosia Abala case who said, that's exactly it. You know, we're in a Minority Report situation and we're being asked to prosecute people for their thoughts. One idea was proposed by Richard Walton, who was the head of counterterrorism during the 2012 Olympics in London for the police force there. And he spoke to me about the fact that in the months leading up to the Olympics, what he and his team did, what they realized is that a lot of these suspects that are radicalized are also often petty criminals. They're driving without a license. They're getting into fights. And so what he did and his team is they looked at the list and they began very aggressively looking at whether there were any small infringements of the law. Somebody drives without a license, you pull him off the street, and he says that in the time it takes you to push him through the legal system, you then have time to ask them questions, right? And determine, is this person in a state of radicalization that we consider critical or dangerous? And it's hard to compare apples to apples. 2012 was really before the rise of ISIS as we know it. Mm-hmm. So it's unclear whether that technique would have worked now, but it is an idea.
Rukmini Kalamaki of the New York Times. Always great to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco. It's a pleasure.
When someone does something as horrific as the Orlando shooter did, people react with anger and revulsion. That's only natural. But it also means that it can be hard for the families of notorious killers, like Omar Mateen, to find a place to bury them.
For instance, I think Lee Harvey Oswald, his body was passed around for quite a bit before it found a regular place.
That's Ann Newman, who wrote the book, The Good Death, An Exploration of Dying in America.
In the case of Tamer Tsarnaev, the Boston Marathon bomber,
the brother of the one who died. Yeah.
Correct. It took ages to find a place for his body. In fact, there was a real problem in that, Cambridge said, we're not going to have that body here. And so pleas were going out to various cemeteries to find a place that would take his body. And it was finally a woman in Virginia who raised the money and found the space and donated it to the family.
I mean, basically what happens is burial rights become public safety issues. Is there a worry that the burial spot just could become a gathering spot for sympathizers and for protesters?
I don't think that that really happens. When I was writing about the San Bernardino incident and the challenge of finding a place for those bodies, no San Bernardino mosque would take the couple's bodies. And so the family had to find a place out in the Antelope Valley. And when I got out there, the real problem was not that people wanted to flock to these graves to become radicalized Muslims. It's that Islamophobic groups were very concerned about the body being there. And we, in this so-called secular age, forget that bodies have incredible power still, maybe more so.
So for families, whether they're Muslim or non-Muslim, how hard is it to want to kind of publicly support a burial for someone who, you know, is part of their family but is abhorrent to society at large?
Well, first of all, imagine the emotion of raising a son who then commits a crime like this.
Or a daughter.
Or a daughter. Yeah, thank you. And it's hard to imagine what that experience must be like. But then also, you know, the Klebolds, for instance, had...
the family of one of the Columbine shooters, yeah?
Exactly. They had their entire church community turn on them. And the community at large, the pastor that supported them ended up leaving his service to the church because many families felt as though this family did not deserve kind of the sympathy, that they had some sort of role in what had taken place. So that has to be traumatizing, the whole experience. And then how do you acknowledge your love for this person in your family, for this son or daughter? And I think we see that across the board for Muslim families as well as non-Muslim families.
Anne Newman is the author of The Good Death, An Exploration of Dying in America. Thank you very much, Anne, for your time today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Later on the show, a Jewish family in Berlin has a new house guest. He's a refugee from Syria. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. In San Diego, an after-school program helps young immigrants feel less alienated. For this teenager, it was a lifesaver.
Kids would come up to me and they would say, like, hi, weird girl, and then I wouldn't understand anything. I would feel like, oh, this is a country that I'm not supposed to be in.
That's coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We are a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Campaigners for the UK to leave the European Union sold the vote on a combination of myth, fear, and nostalgia. They wanted to take Britain back to a world that may never have even existed. You know, tea cozies and corgis, the kind of place evoked by A.A. Milne in Winnie the Pooh. So it intrigued me to read a column in the New Statesman with the headline, I Want My Country Back. Lori Penny wrote that she wanted a Britain that's tolerant and respects its neighbors. She admits that's also a myth. So I wanted to know, if both visions of a perfect Britain are false, what model should the UK follow?
If there was an easy model, I think we'd all be a bit calmer in this country right now. There is no real map for how to manage a country fracturing under the ravages of modern neoliberalism. And I don't think nationalism and, you know, parochialism is an adequate response or any kind of response to austerity and to hardship and to the real suffering that is a result of globalization.
Laurie used the G word there, globalization. I mean, the people who really felt in their bones that they needed to vote to get out of the European Union, we heard some of their concern was about immigration, but that a lot of anger was also inward looking and a sense among people they had not gotten their slice of the pie. What do you think about that? Because that sounds very familiar.
The latter is absolutely correct. Unfortunately, this wasn't a vote about that. The EU vote was rephrased as, leaving the EU will solve all of our problems. It was never really explained how this was meant to happen. Something to do with immigration, presumably. But now it turns out that actually we may not even be able to close down the borders as people at the head of the Leave campaign were promising. So people who voted Leave have been sold an absolute fiction to service the political careers of a few wealthy men at the top of the pile. But yes, there are some real legitimate concerns out there, not necessarily about immigration, but it is true that in Britain, particularly over the last 6 years since David Cameron came to power, that, yeah, ordinary people, it's not just that they haven't had their slice of the pie, the wealth gap has been growing hugely in Britain. There's been a vast gulf of inequality has opened up. Unemployment is part of the issue, but there's also underemployment. People are being paid poverty wages across the country, particularly in deprived areas in the north, in former industrial areas, in inner city areas. There is a huge social divide in Britain, and that was the case before the referendum. Unfortunately, it's only now that people seem to be paying attention to it when it's actually, you know, impacted on their chance of getting re-elected or hanging on to their positions.
Well, people in the United States are paying attention to the UK because what you're talking about is a trope here in the US as well. I mean, this feeling that globalization happened and it was a party that a lot of people didn't get invites to. It's a trope Donald Trump is talking about and getting traction with. And you even point out that Trump and Marine Le Pen in France congratulated the UK on its leave vote. Is the UK taking cues from the US or is the US taking cues from the UK?
Well, it sounds like people are reading off the same terrible playbook in both Britain and America, which is a few wealthy demagogues with no eye on anything apart from their own future and their own power are exploiting a really terrible situation with no concern for what it's going to do to the social fabric of their country. A lot of people, even people who voted for Leave, are saying, oh, we didn't think it could really happen. We didn't think it could happen here. It was just a protest vote because we hate the political class. Well, they're right to hate the political class. The political class have not done them any favours in the past 10 years at least, if ever. But the lessons to be drawn is that, yes, it really can happen. It really has happened in the UK, and we're all nervously wondering what the fallout's going to be.
You call the politician demagogues like David Cameron and Boris Johnson, or did they just not think this through?
When I use the phrase demagogue, I'm talking about a particular kind of personality. I'm talking about Trump, but I'm also talking about Nigel Farage and Boris Johnson, who are charismatic leaders who are prepared to exploit any situation of public outrage to their own advantage.
Regardless of what the Brexit vote was, wasn't the UK eventually going to have to come to terms with what a united Kingdom ought to be? I mean, you've got 48% who see it open, 52% who see it with a kind of velvet rope in front of it. What will this new country look like?
Well, hopefully it won't be a smoking wasteland by the time we get to the end of this situation. I honestly...
You're honestly concerned about that?
That's a figure of speech.
Sure.
But we have no idea what's going to happen just in the next week. The shadow cabinet, which is the opposition, are imploding just today. We have no idea who's going to be leader of the main two political parties in 2 or 3 days. We have no idea what's going to happen to the pound. Nobody really knows. It turns out that nobody had a plan, you see. All of these former Etonian politicians, you know, Boris Johnson and David Cameron, friends at school, friends at Oxford, have been political rivals for a very, very long time, vying for the leadership of the country. It turns out that neither of them had a plan with what to do in the case of a Brexit. The only leader who seems to have any clue what's going on is Nicola Sturgeon, who is the head of the Scottish National Party. And, personally, I woke up this morning thinking, you know, wouldn't it be a good thing if Scotland invaded us? You know, they used to do that all the time. Maybe they could start again. Do they still have any dudes who can do that? Yeah. It's like she seems like the only, but maybe she's the Khaleesi we need.
Yeah, get the blue war paint ready.
Yes, absolutely. Please.
Laurie Penny, great to speak with you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Scotland's not the only part of the UK that voted to remain. A majority of voters in Northern Ireland did as well, and some are so rattled by Brexit that they're looking into getting new passports. I mean Irish ones, as in the Republic of Ireland, which has no plans to leave the European Union. My colleague Chris Page is Ireland correspondent for the BBC. He's been following the story.
After Brexit, people are thinking, well, what happens now? Can I remain an EU citizen? Can I have an EU passport, even if my country is leaving the European Union? And a lot of people have decided that the way to do that is to apply for an Irish passport. So across Belfast over the weekend in particular, you had post offices running out of application forms for Irish passports. You even saw a sign outside a couple of post offices. I saw them myself saying, sorry, no more Irish passport forms left. And today, the Irish Foreign Minister, Charlie Flanagan, has actually moved to try to calm people down here. He's reminded people that though the UK is leaving the EU, that's not going to happen for at least another couple of years while the negotiations take place. Mm. There's no real rush to apply for Irish citizenship, and he's worried about the Irish Passport Service being overwhelmed by the number of applications.
Do we know any more about whether a physical border is going to be put up between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland? And how would that work? Any more discussion about that?
It's still very early days, and that is certainly one of the key things which people here are discussing. What's going to be very, very important in working that out will be Ireland's role in the negotiations. The Irish Prime Minister, Enda Kenny, spoke in the Irish Parliament today. They had an emergency session about Brexit, and Mr. Kenny said that the border would be one of the Irish government's top priorities whenever they're taking part in these negotiations. It is an unprecedented situation. Nobody's quite sure what's going to happen.
You were in the Republic of Ireland over the weekend, now back at base in Belfast. How are people on both sides feeling about this possibility, understanding that it's still kind of hard to say what's happening next?
I think in the Republic of Ireland, people really are extremely worried about what Brexit is going to mean. The relationship between the UK and Ireland is crucial for the Irish economy when you think of the trading market. Also, just the very close cultural ties really between the two countries, even though Irish identity is very distinct. People in Ireland will think nothing of flying across the Irish Sea to take in a rugby match in London, for example, or going over to watch their favourite soccer team in Manchester. So I think people are worried about how it might disrupt lives in all sorts of ways. Now, in Northern Ireland, most people, I'd say, are feeling disappointed. There's certainly anxiety around what it might mean for the economy and for the political settlement here, for relationships between the communities. But there are certainly people, plenty of people, in fact, who are pleased with the result.
Well, let's talk briefly as a final point on that political settlement, because another topic that has a lot of people talking is whether Brexit would affect the peace settlement in Northern Ireland. And Sinn Féin, the main party that wants to see Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland reunite, actually called this weekend for a referendum on that. Is there any chance of that happening? And generally, what could be the effect on the peace settlement?
I don't think there's any chance of that happening, certainly in the short term. A referendum in the future of Northern Ireland under the peace agreements can only be called by the British government if there's evidence that a majority of people in Northern Ireland might vote to join up with the Republic of Ireland. And the British government and the Irish government have both said they don't think that is indeed the case. As regards the political settlement, well, I think there's very much a consensus that a Brexit will not substantially damage the peace process. It's bedded down very well now. There's been peace basically for almost 20 years. So nobody's really talking about the possibility that violence could return. But I do think people are looking at Northern Ireland's status, and it has certainly sparked a debate about a number of areas around the status of Northern Ireland, and that debate was not there before Brexit.
Chris Page in Belfast. He is the Ireland correspondent for our partners at the BBC. Chris, thanks again.
Thank you very much indeed, Marco.
One of the images that fueled the Brexit vote to leave the EU was a poster. It showed a massive line of refugees and migrants waiting to get into Europe. But it's not just Britain that's uneasy about migrants and refugees. Sweden just moved to make it harder for refugees to settle there, and Germany is struggling with its relatively open-door policy. Still, many Germans continue to welcome refugees, including one Jewish family that we're going to hear about in our next story. The family is hosting a young Syrian Muslim man in their home in Berlin. Here's Daniel Estrin.
The Jelinek family invited me for Friday Shabbat dinner at their apartment in downtown Berlin. Their Syrian houseguest, Kinan, was in charge of the food.
What are you making?
Rice, kawaj, a Syrian stew with tomatoes and onions, ground beef with garlic, and lentil soup. Kinan is 28. and he's been living with the Yelinics since November.
He learned how to cook from YouTube?
Yeah.
He started cooking for himself when he left Damascus on his own and made the long journey from Turkey to Greece and finally to Germany. He ended up in a refugee shelter in Berlin, and eventually he met Chaim.
My name is Chaim Jelinek, and I live together with my family.
His wife and his four kids. They belong to an egalitarian synagogue in Berlin, where men and women participate equally in the services. It's an old synagogue that Nazi forces once seized and used as a warehouse.
My synagogue is involved in refugee aid. They do a lot, and I really think that's the only good way to solve that problem, to get a connection to the refugees and to welcome them.
Chaim and his wife Kira were volunteering with Syrian refugees when they heard about Kinan. The Yelinek's 20-year-old son had moved out of the house.
So the room was free, and we said, okay, we try.
So Kinan moved in. At a time of growing skepticism among Germans about the million-plus newcomers to the country, mostly from the Middle East. Germany's Jewish community in particular has mixed feelings about it.
I think most of the Jewish community want to welcome refugees. That's one side. And the other side is that many Jewish people fear radical Islamism, of course.
The head of the Central Council for Jews in Germany has called for the country to set a limit on the number of migrants arriving, saying while many refugees are fleeing the terror of ISIS, they come from cultures with a hatred of Jews. Kinan says when he met Chaim, Chaim told him his family was Jewish. Kinan says he had no problem with that. He knows there's bitterness between Arabs and Jews in the Middle East, but Kinan says he never saw Jews as an enemy. And he says that even though there's animosity between Israel and Syria, it's a matter of politics that has nothing to do with religion. Food was ready. So Chaim, Kira, their four kids, and Kinan sat down at the dinner table. Chaim handed out yarmulkes for his sons to wear. Kinan put one on too. The family recited the blessings over the Sabbath candles and the wine and the challah bread. They ate and joked for hours. Kinan laughed along with them, then admitted that he didn't really understand a lot of the German. And everyone laughed. He did too.
It's great. It's amazing because you learn a lot from each other, like cooking, like celebrating Shabbat.
This is Chaim's 18-year-old daughter, Rosa.
Like a few weeks ago, he said goodnight to me, but he said it in a wrong way. And then I told him, okay, you have to say goodnight or not, I don't know, night good or whatever he would have said in English. And then he said it wrong like three times or three evenings. But then he started saying it the right way. And it was like just nice to see that he learned some more German, that I can help him.
After dinner, Chaim Jelinek sat on the sofa. He reflected on his country's warm welcome to refugees beginning last year.
This has been one of the most important things in my life because with that moment we saw a completely different Germany, something we hadn't seen before. Open-minded, friendly, really friendly.
Chaim converted to Judaism years ago. His mother-in-law survived the Budapest ghetto during World War II. The family is sensitive to the dilemma of being Jewish in post-Holocaust Germany. As Germany has given a home to newcomers from a different religion and culture, Chaim says he's felt more at home himself.
There's more clarity that we are different, but we are allowed to live that difference as Jews.
Kinan is taking German classes full-time now. 8-year-old Lily and 12-year-old Yoshi help him with his homework.
We've been very lucky to meet Kinan because it makes our family richer, and it's a good experience. He opened the door for all of us to look at that country in a different way.
For the World, Daniel Estrin, Berlin.
Coming up, Bolivia's president wants to adopt a 13-month year. It's on the World. Our next story is about what happens after migrants and refugees make it to the U.S. They take all kinds of risks to get here, but the risks don't stop at the border. Many of them face discrimination and outright hostility. It can make newcomers feel alienated. But one after-school program in San Diego is trying to ease that feeling among young immigrants. Jean Guerrero of KPBS has our story.
Amir Mati is 11 years old and remembers the day her little brother was almost kidnapped near their home in Guatemala.
My little brother comes running to us and he says, "Someone tried to get me."
A passing driver rescued her brother from the kidnappers, and Amir's family decided it was time to leave Guatemala and its gang violence. On the way to the U.S., Mexican officials stopped them and put them in a detention center for more than 5 months. Amir says it was a nightmare.
Like, you couldn't sleep because there were these huge bugs that, like, were, like, roaming around the whole place, like 1,000 of them.
When the family made it to the U.S., they applied for asylum. Amir thought the nightmare was over, but she realized it wasn't as soon as she started second grade in San Diego. Learning English was tough. And she'd missed months of school when she was detained in Mexico.
Because, like, those 5 past months, I didn't learn anything. I felt dumb because I didn't know the answers to any of the questions that my teacher would ask me.
She also says her classmates bullied her.
Kids would come up to me and they would say, like, "Hi, weird girl," and then I wouldn't understand anything. I would feel like, oh, this is a country that I'm not supposed to be in, that I'm not welcome here.
But then her family learned about YALA, an after-school program that started 6 years ago. It teaches soccer to refugee and immigrant students, using that as a fun hook to get academic mentoring. Quickly, Amira caught up with her classmates, coached by YALA's mentors and its ESL software that helps with reading and writing.
When, like, you didn't understand something in English, then it would explain it to you in Spanish, and then it would tell you to repeat it.
She also felt she belonged somewhere. At YALA, students come from Iraq, Sudan, Honduras, and elsewhere. They bond because they've all been uprooted. Amira's little brother, Mati, the one nearly kidnapped in Guatemala, is 8, and he practices English at the YALA program.
It will be sunny for 5 days.
Yes.
Helping him was Riyam Mansour, an Iraqi refugee. She says the friendships between the students and mentors, many who are immigrants, are key to the program's success. The soccer part helps build ties, too, she says.
With soccer, you don't usually need a language to speak it. It's like a universal language.
This year, 20 high schoolers graduated from the YALA program. Most received college scholarships. But Mark Caban, who started YALA, now notices a change ahead of the next round of funding. Some donors are withholding their support. He thinks it's because of the current immigration debate.
Politically, what's happening, I think, the shift in the public attitude towards immigrants, and especially people coming from the Middle East, has affected our young people.
Caban also says that YALA students are complaining of more discrimination at school.
Our scholar athletes are coming to us and saying we feel discriminated against. In our 6 years, I've never heard that before. And I don't know what to kind of tell them other than, hey, this is who we are. We're going to stick together and we're going to keep working hard and we're going to keep being the best people we can be.
Amira from Guatemala says the support at YALA helps her believe in herself and stay ambitious.
I want to be a heart surgeon.
She says, though, that some of her non-immigrant classmates have told her she can't be a surgeon because she's Guatemalan. But, she says, she's keeping her eyes on the goal. For the World, Jean Guerrero, San Diego.
Finally today, it's 2016 for most of us, but for the president of Bolivia, it's the year 5524. Evo Morales wants to ditch the Gregorian calendar and revert to Bolivia's indigenous calendar that was used thousands of years ago. President Morales is of Aymara descent, and Aymaras are one of the largest indigenous groups in Bolivia. Paul Goldstein is an anthropologist at the University of California, San Diego. He's an expert on the Aymara and their ancient capital, Tiwanaku. I asked him how their calendar works.
The calendar that President Morales is proposing is an adaptation of a 13-month calendar that uses a beginning date of 1492, the arrival of Columbus in the New World, as a marking point and adds 5,000 years before that point as an assumption of a long-term occupation by Tiwanaku and other peoples of the indigenous Andes. It works basically beginning with the winter solstice, which is June 21st.
How much support is there in Bolivia for changing the calendar back?
With Evo Morales, there's been a huge wave of popularity for things ancient, things Tiwanaku, things Aymara. It's a very big part of Bolivian nationalism, which we could call an almost archaeological nationalism, that what the modern multi-ethnic state is really just the heir to much, much more ancient legitimacy. So in a sense, it's part and parcel of this sort of larger awakening of Aymara identity as a very important part of Bolivian nationalism. The idea of a calendar sort of fits into this idea also of setting themselves apart from the 500 years of oppression since the advent of Columbus. So hence the 1492 year is a particularly telling part of the use of this calendar.
How would that affect business and communication with the rest of the world?
I think of it more as a statement, an important thought experiment, and a way of thinking about difference that is very important to Bolivia as a nation.
The country is officially known as the plurinational state of Bolivia. The country's got a second flag, an indigenous flag, which is rainbow-colored, and it flies along the traditional flag. Are these ideas changing Bolivian sense of themselves?
Multi-ethnicity is actually a part of ancient Tiwanaku that can't be overemphasized. So the idea of ethnicities living together alongside one another, maintaining very proud identities, is in fact one of the most ancient contributions of the ancestors of the Aymara, the Tiwanaku. So having them side by side is, I think, a great metaphor for the idea that perhaps calendars can live side by side, one to function externally to match the world system, and the other for this very important element of national and indigenous identities.
Yeah, speaking of culture, calendars, and the passage of time, a few years ago, you may know Evo Morales famously changed the clock in La Paz so the hands turn left and the numbers are inverted to go from 1 to 12 counterclockwise. What was that all about?
There's some interesting cognitive science research on metaphoric concepts of time. And in the Aymara language, or at least in the Aymara language and gesture system, there's a tendency to consider the future to be behind oneself and the past in front. People gesture behind them when they're talking about the future. So there's some interesting kind of correlates to particularly Aymara conceptions of time and the passage of time.
Wow, mind officially blown. That was anthropologist Paul Goldstein telling me about Bolivia's old calendar, which may be new again. I try not to let my mind be blown more than once a day, so we'll leave it there on this Monday. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.